Our guest today is a scholar of West Asian geopolitics who's been studying, monitoring, and breathing Iran's foreign policy. Dr. Deepika Saraswat, welcome to India, Russia, and the World.
Thank you.
You study conflicts, diplomacy, regional rivalries at the very core of it, Iran. You've written books on it as well. How would you describe what's happening in Iran and West Asia today?
The question that you ask has no easy answer, so it's going to take me a while. US and Israel having launched a war nearly 3 weeks ago, it's been building up for a while. I mean, I would actually like to go back to Trump's last term in the White House in 2018 when he withdrew from the nuclear deal with Iran that President Obama had signed, and it had sort of taken care of the proliferation concerns about Iran's nuclear program. He withdrew from the deal saying it wasn't good enough, and he had the support of the Gulf countries, which were not too happy about the nuclear deal, and Israel, of course. So when he withdrew from the agreement and launched a maximum pressure, sanction-based maximum pressure on Iran, and we see that this escalation, which has now come up in such a way, starts to build up. Israel and Iran, they get caught in a shadow war, because Israel started a covert campaign against a sabotage campaign against Iran's nuclear program, which Iran had, after 1 year since U.S. withdrawal, it had started to accelerate its nuclear program. And then Israel starts a sabotage campaign. There's a shadow war also plays out in Syria, where Israel started bombing Iranian weapon transshipment to Hezbollah. And then this was the time that Naftali Bennett, then Prime Minister of Israel, came up with the Octopus Doctrine, where Israel calculated that the proxy forces, or the forces like Hezbollah, Hamas, that Iran had supported on periphery of Israel, that Israel was going to take the war to Iran, that they were no longer just going to deal with the tentacles of the octopus, so to speak, but strike at the head. And after October 7, we see that shadow war comes out and open when Israel strikes Iranian consulate in Damascus in April 2024, killing senior IRGC commanders. And then Iran strikes back with missile and drone strikes on the Israeli territory for the first time. And then we see the escalation against Hezbollah in later that year, in 2024. Hezbollah chief is killed, but once Hezbollah is decimated, Israel is convinced now that they can take the war to Iran. And they think they have an opportunity to deal with the Iranian threat as they see it for once and for all. Mm-hmm. And they have a very supportive administration in the White House.
And would you say that the killing of Ayatollah Khamenei really is the single biggest development in this conflict? And perhaps this is something that might shape the entire modern history of West Asia.
So the strategy seems to be that from air campaign, you destroy the coercive apparatus, and then you egg on, or that you try to appeal to the Iranian people to rise up. So this taking out or the regime decapitation, killing of Khamenei, is part of that strategic goal. But of course, it has hardened the support base of the Islamic Republic. The Iranian leadership now sees that this is an existential war. When you take out the supreme leader, they know, they understand that this is a war of survival.
Question that many are asking is, why wasn't Ayatollah Khamenei in a bunker or in a safe house? Why was he where he was? Do you think that this is driven in any way by the belief in the concept of martyrdom?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. The Shia, this whole concept of martyrdom, the Battle of Karbala and the ultimate sacrifice of Imam Hussein. I mean, the story being that Imam Hussein had a small army of 72 people facing and totally outnumbered by the army of his adversary, Yazid. And he chose to fight against an unjust power and sacrificed and embraced martyrdom, which means that when you see a fight that is righteous cause, it's for your nation, it's for defense of your faith, you embrace martyrdom. So that kind of action, he knows that it will have severe ramifications for, you know, inspiring and mobilizing regime base. So
it did not stop at Ayatollah Khomeini. The security chief, Larijani, his death also now is something that is talked about, but also seeing the lot of scrutiny.
So over here, it's very evident that Israeli and U.S. strategy seems to be to continue with regime decapitation, that you keep on thinning the top strata of people who can govern the country, who can carry on with the war effort. So that way, Ali Larijani, who was the security chief, he was a key person in charge of the war effort and the decision making as the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council. There will be somebody else in the line. So, but I don't think this capacity to sort of keep replacing is unlimited. At some point, it will start having effects. And that's probably what, the Israeli-U.S. strategy seems to be.
Working?
At this point, no. But, I mean, it all depends on how long this goes on. I mean...
And that's what I was going to ask you. Perhaps a very simplistic question, and I shouldn't, but let me. In your opinion, how long will this chaos, this conflict, this war go on for?
It's very hard to say. I mean, as an analyst, I mean, I really cannot make a definite, you know, response to that. But one thing is for sure, that as it drags on, the escalation is going to, you know, climb up the escalation ladder. I mean, there's going to be, I mean, if you take out Ali Larijani, which they did, now Iranians also have to respond. How do they do that? If Americans are threatening to take over the Kurg Island, then Iranians are also going to escalate their targeting of the energy facilities, oil and gas fields. And then you're going to climb up and up. And then at some point, I mean, you are in a very uncharted kind of a scenario. I mean, how long can this
fight go? There are some analysts who are based on several theories and calculations are saying that this is headed towards World War III. Do you see any merit there?
Not really. I mean, one thing is very, very evident, that this war has not remained contained to Iran, mm-hmm. as something, which is something maybe Israelis and the Americans imagined, that Iran was weak enough and they can contain the conflict, and whatever that Iranians had been warning, that if they are attacked, that it will lead to a regional war, it will lead to control, closure or disruption in the Strait of Hormuz. Israelis and Americans didn't seem to prepare for that kind of scenario. It appears that way. So now we have a regional war. But to say that it may lead to a World War III, I'm not seeing that happening, given that U.S. has also failed to mobilize a broader coalition against Iran. Europeans don't want to come. German president, chancellor, what did he say? This is not our war. He may say things like, okay, that international law does not apply to Iran and things like that. But he has not he doesn't want to commit
right.
to this war. The statement is quite telling, where he says, what would a few more European frigates will achieve what American naval power has not been achieved. Mm-hmm. Similarly, the Japan, South Korea, they are not going to come. We don't see either side being able to attract or mobilize a bigger coalition in their support.
The U.S. calls the IRGC a terror organization, but it's the U.S. that bombs the supreme leader of a nation. It's the U.S. that kills over 2,000 people of another country and then offers bounties on survivors. Is that not what a classic terror state is supposed to be?
Well, over the years now, we've seen that how the rule-based order has just become a thing of past. I mean, we have Peter Hegseth saying, what rules of game? Let's just forget about those stupid rules of game. So we see that, and there was like
But is this
previously,
Western bureaucracy then?
evidently, I mean, the answer is, I mean, it's quite plain. I mean, let me just make this one point that when George Bush invaded Iraq, he tried to mobilize a coalition of willing. He tried to, I mean, it was probably discussed in the UN Security Council. This time, we don't see that Donald Trump administration even attempting to do anything like that. That you want to give it a even a veneer of some kind of, you know, justification under international law or something like that. So I think we've kind of moved into a very different kind of world where it's no longer about question of hypocrisy. It just, I mean, it's a far more meaner and anarchic world in that sense. I mean, where international law and institutions do not really seem to be respected or cared by most of the, I mean, these actors.
Iran says that it will not go in for a ceasefire because it wasn't Iran that started this war. What does that say about the political messaging of the country and also the military preparedness?
I mean, see, Iran has you know, major asymmetry when it comes to facing forces like Israel and the United States, who are conventionally far, far superior in terms of the air power. Iran doesn't have an air force. It primarily relies on its missile program, both ballistic missiles and a big arsenal of cruise missiles, anti-ship missiles. So that's something that they have, you know, worked on for a long time. They started developing their missile program after Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. So, and they know they knew that this war would come at some point. Learning from that lesson and from earlier wars, as the foreign minister himself said, they have dispersed their military equipment. Their command and control is decentralized, which kind of allows them to not only have flexibility and a speed of retaliation, but also survive for a longer period of time. I mean, we are already 3 weeks into the war, and they've shown a capability for carrying out an attritional warfare, that they have a local industrial base. They make their own missiles, and they have large inventories fortified. Iranians seem to have a strategy in place where they have the sort of, they can carry on this attritional warfare for quite some time. And their strategy is cost imposition. Let's have this clear. I mean, they're not fighting, that they are not doing tit for tat kind of strikes. They don't have that capacity. So what they have done is to make sure that the costs are borne by the regional countries and also globally. So that's their main strategy, that by disrupting the energy flows through Strait of Hormuz, and if things go worse, and then they can even, I mean, they can close it, not just the Strait of Hormuz, but also Bab el-Mandeb, the alternate. The Iranians understand that after the last year's war, the Americans and Israelis came back again to degrade their ballistic missile the capabilities. And for Iran, that kind of scenario is no good, that you fight a war and then you go for a ceasefire and then you are facing a similar situation again. So their strategy seems to be that you cause enough pain, you impose enough costs to have some kind of new equation, deterrence equation, where they will think twice before striking Iran again. So from the day one, the Iranian messaging has been that we are not in a hurry for ceasefire.
Do you think one of the reasons for Iran's confidence and defiance is that it's not as isolated as the US thought it would be?
You know, in Iran's case, the analysts have spoken about something called strategic loneliness. Iran, their own sense is that they are quite lonely, actually, that nobody really shares their predicament, security predicament. And that concept is has very deep, sort of, it's quite deep-rooted, because Iran is a Shia Persian country, nation, in a largely Sunni Arab neighborhood. And then Iran has been challenging the US dominance in the region, while most of its neighbors actually have US bases and they depend on US security umbrella. So that way, nobody really shares Iran's strategic orientation in the immediate neighborhood.
What role could Russia play in diffusing the tensions in the region?
Well, I think both Russia and China actually, they see a role for themselves in the region, which has been dominated by the United States. And they try to use, you know, different diplomatic and even, you know, at different times they've tried to cultivate, let's say, you know, sell equipment to some of the Gulf countries, but they also try to play a diplomatic role. So here we see both Russia and China would try to, you know, urge the Gulf countries to sort of be, you know, not get involved in the on the U.S.-Israeli side, and maybe even try to sort of provide some kind of dialogue between, I mean, Iran and the Gulf side, that it doesn't go completely out of control.
Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they are the largest investors in U.S. companies and U.S. treasury bonds and in Wall Street funds as well. Do you think it's this financial entanglement that really is the reason why the Gulf countries can never really break away from the U.S.?
These countries, they have very ambitious economic agenda. They want to further, you know, enhance their role in the global economy. And for that, they see United States as a key partner. It is kind of related to the security agreements that these countries have with the United States. But they have also realized that these Gulf states, that the United States is no longer a reliable security partner. So one would imagine that when this war ends, they will also have to do a lot of rethink in terms of what they were promising to the United States and what they've received. The basic thing that they want is security and stability, and they have not received that. And they find themselves in the war front, you know, of a war that they did not start. They actively tried to prevent.
Do you see global supply chains being affected beyond just oil and gas?
I mean, why not? The Gulf is not, Gulf has three main functions in the global economy: energy, trade routes, and capital. All of that is going to be impacted. And the longer this war goes on, deeper will be the effects. And I doubt that any major economy is insulated from that kind of effect. Of course, it will play out.
Is this the death of Chabahar port? India's very ambitious international port, India's first international port.
No, I would not jump to those kind of conclusions. I mean, this was first project of its kind that we carried out, you know, outside of our country. And we've been very resilient despite a lot of challenges, sanctions and the U.S. expectations there. 2024, we signed a 10-year agreement, and that came after we got most of the equipment and the port became operational. And this port has its strong strategic logic for India. We need that port to access Afghanistan, to have an independent transport corridor to Central Asia. So that's not going to go away.
And how crucial is Iran for India's connectivity ambitions?
Given Pakistan denies us overland transit to Afghanistan and Central Asia, that's a post-partition entrapment that Pakistan uses a veto for, you know, denying our overland transit, which is very important for us to have normal economic relations with Central Asian countries, with Afghanistan. So Iran is the natural gateway for us. So, and that's not going to change.
There's a lot being talked about the need for mediation in the West Asia conflict. What country do you see here play a role? Is it going to be India? Is it going to be Russia or any other country in the world?
None of the sides are actually showing willingness to de-escalate. They are not searching for an off-ramp at this point. I mean, either side has to sort of come down to this decision. Okay, they want to come down, they want to de-escalate because of whatever reasons that. So they have to come to that conclusion first. I mean, we've seen in Russia, Ukraine, I mean, the war has been going on for 4 years. I mean, where is the mediation? Successful mediation? Has the war really stopped? Because both sides have to first come to this understanding that either they've achieved their goals or they realize that it's no longer possible, and then they look for an exit.
In your opinion, how is the Russia-Ukraine conflict different than the Iran conflict, the Iran war that's going on right now?
I mean, because there's a huge asymmetry here.
But you know, what I'm trying to ask is, many say that in the Iran war, in the Iran conflict, the US-Israeli strikes, all rules, traditional rules of a conflict were broken.
This war, I mean, the kind of decapitation that we've seen, and, you know, striking the political leadership, and then, you know, on the day one, there was a strike against a school. Those many hundreds of girls were killed, and the use of AI that we hear about, how, I mean, it's not as smart as one is made to believe. And so definitely it's a very bloody war with significant human cost. And as I said, rules of games nobody really seems to care about.
Have sanctions weakened Iran, or have they forced Iran to become more self-sufficient?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a country which has been under sanctions for as long as the Islamic Republic has existed. So, I mean, one key lesson that they learned from Iran-Iraq war was self-reliance, self-sufficiency. So their missile program is, I mean, they did get help initially from a host of countries, North Korea, and maybe the Chinese on anti-ship missiles and elsewhere. But they have industrial base. I mean, their drone program. I mean, they set up a factory for the Russians in Alabuga. So they have an indigenous defense industrial base. So yes, the sanctions kind of force you to do that.
Has the US's maximum pressure strategy ultimately failed?
Maximum pressure has failed to the extent that it has not led Iran to surrender. So yes, in that sense, the maximum pressure failed. Iran has chosen to fight for its survival, to fight for its identity, to maintain its strategic orientation. It has not capitulated under pressure.
Is India losing its strategic space in Iran due to the US pressure?
Well, you know, on Iran and India, as I said earlier, for us, Iran is a maritime neighbor, it's a civilizational partner. It's part of our extended neighborhood. So no matter what, we have to have channels open. We have to have engagement with the country. And that, in my opinion, has not changed over the years. It still continues. Our external affairs minister is in touch with his counterpart in Iran. So for us, no external pressure or third party can put us in a situation where we, you know, just not engage with Iran.
In your opinion, can India simultaneously engage, balance its relationship with Iran, Israel, and the US?
I think Indian policy, Indian approach towards West Asia in last 15 years or so has kind of indicated that we have a capacity to have relations with everyone. I mean, there are these fault lines in the region, but because of the economic importance, because it's our extended neighborhood, we cannot make these zero-sum kind of ties where we engage with one and leave out the other. That's just not an option for us. And I think India has very well kind of walked the tightrope where we have dealt with different pulls and pressures and managed to keep our relationship, on the bilateral terms, pretty much continued despite all the crises and, you know, the conflict.
Dr. Deepika Saraswat, many thanks for your time.
Thank you.